We're in the sixth chapter of Romans. It needs a lot of ferreting out. It needs a lot of understanding because it is too tempting for people to get very, very religious about this and sanctimonious about it and set standards for themselves that are, in the first place, not really what is said here, but in the second place, set standards they can't even handle. There's no use putting standards out there that nobody reaches, but everybody talks about. Everybody's preaching it, but nobody's reaching it. And the problem with it is everybody is discouraged then. You know, everybody feels like second-rate Christians. And that's what I'm trying to help you get hold of here. I want you back in the ball game, as I said last week. I don't want you sitting on the sidelines figuring that the real players are out there on the field and you're being left behind, because I've tried to tell you the people that you may think are the head honchos of the faith are not doing any different than you're doing. We're all just there struggling together to follow Christ. I think the crucial issue to you as we look at this chapter, where we're talking about the presenting of ourselves to God as instruments of righteousness and so forth, those are pretty powerful words, but I want to show you what they really mean. But the thing to keep in your mind is that as far as your spirits are concerned, they are occupied by Christ if you have asked him to come in. And your spirit is his, and you are at peace in your spirit. You have the presence of the Spirit and the gifts of the Spirit there, but you're going to be struggling in the flesh. You see that? You're not ever going to, in all your life on this earth, be able to kick the flesh out and say, I'm never going to be in the flesh again. I hear statements from the top leaders of Christendom that I listen to, and I say, that's in the flesh, you know. And then they would admit it if they got down to the nitty-gritty with me. They don't always say everything just right. I read magazine articles about some of the leaders and some of these people that I've had personal fellowship with, know personally. I read these articles and I think to myself, well, they would have to admit, if they were really honest about it, that they function just about like the rest of us. Just simple souls doing our best to get it by. We're struggling to get along with Christ. We're not given a free ride. And to give you this kind of liberty does not mean that you are free to do whatever you want to. It only means that in your struggle, you're not put on the sidelines. You know, the struggle is part of the game, of the main thrust of our lives, that struggle. It's always there. As you go along in the Spirit, that is, as the Spirit of Christ is in our hearts, we get help and guidance, and we learn how to cope with life. We learn how more to go in the strength of the Lord, not to depend upon ourselves. And so there's much maturing that we can do, but what we're really trying to say is that in the struggle, Christ is with you, and don't think you're ever going to be beyond the struggle. That's all. So when Paul talks here about yielding your members as instruments of righteousness, he's not saying you're never again going to make a mistake. Now, if you make one mistake, it indicates that the flesh is still with you. Or if you make 20. We have talked about this matter of the speed laws of the state, and they're good. It's a good illustration of some of the points we've been trying to make to you. There are people who feel that if you're really a Christian, you know, really living with Christ, you're not going to violate any laws. You know, it is known that you may be traveling 65 or so. Some people get a little horrified about that because as a Christian, you shouldn't be breaking that law. So now the question, the gut question is, to such a person, did you ever drive 56? Well, that's a tough question. Either is guilty at one point, is guilty of all. I mean, if you drive 56, you're breaking the law. If you go into court with a ticket and you say, look, judge, the officer made a mistake. I was not going 65, I was only going 60. Well, what's the judge going to say? If you're going 56, you broke the law. See, we can get down to that kind of legalism. And that's true in our whole life structure. I told you that before about breaking the law. You can hardly drive an automobile without one way or another violating some law. If you stop your car at a signal and your front wheels are in the crosswalk, you're violating a law. He said, oh yeah, but I saw that officer, he ticketed me and my wheels were not in the crosswalk. Well, he's sitting there watching your wheels, so he probably has a better case than you do, so don't go to court on that. You know, we don't pay any attention to it. Why? Because we're in the spirit of the thing. We're trying to keep the law. We don't just go out and thumb our nose at the local sheriff. We try to maintain a general pattern of good citizenship, right? Well, that's what we're supposed to be doing. But we're flawed human beings. All of these things to bring up basic points that help you keep from making the requirement so rigid that you cannot hope to succeed in pleasing Christ, and therefore you settle back to a second-rate existence as a Christian, thinking of yourself as maybe not very much and not really deserving of Christ's presence with you. Of course, none of us are deserving of his presence with us. But these are things that he recognizes. And I repeat it here because I've got to get this ingrained in your heart. Because this is one of the crucial points in Christendom. How to maintain a daily relationship with Christ that is viable and reasonable and defensible and that you can be at peace about. See? How to do that. And whereas the pressure is on to perform at such a high level, most people are discouraged with it most of the time. And therefore sort of back away from Christ, which is exactly what Satan wants you to do. That's why he loves to see these laws put out. He loves this legalistic position because it keeps everybody discouraged and hanging back. I want you in the ball game. I want you right in there in the middle of it, because you're just, all of us are in Christ and we're all members of his body, and he loves every one of us, and we make our mistakes, but we're all right, see. And like I've said then, this distinction between flesh and spirit, in the sense that any Christian, any day of their life, till the day they die, can and do sometimes approach things in the flesh, and sometimes they approach things in the spirit. You see, it's not an either-or thing. You don't get rid of the flesh and live in the spirit on a plateau, and then you make a mistake, so you're back down in the flesh and you live there for a while, and then you finally get to a conference somewhere and you dedicate your life and you're back up in the spirit again. This is a typical pattern. But it's not like that. The thing is that this night you could do something or say something that comes out of your natural flesh. Anytime you raise your voice at your family, you're in the flesh. You're not in the spirit. You're not coming from Christ. And you're not going to go to hell for it, but you're not coming from Christ. You're just coming from the natural mind. At the same time, you can come from the spirit. The same night, in the same household. You get the family together at the table. And you bow your heads for a moment to invite Christ to your table, to remember him. You're there in the spirit. You're there in the name of Christ. You've invited him to come with you. It's a beautiful moment. You start eating, and first thing you say, all right, Junior, get your elbow out of mashed potatoes, you know. And he comes up with some smart remarks. That beautiful spiritual moment is not there. You're in the flesh, right? Now, you didn't lose your soul. You're not unconverted anymore. You don't have to go back to the altar and get saved all over again. But you operate in the flesh. Now, on the job, every day, sometimes you can operate from a spiritual point of view, and sometimes you're there, you operate in a fleshly way. Now, when I speak of operating in the spirit, I mean when you do it consciously, inviting Christ to participate in that particular function. For example, I think a classic illustration is the functions within the church. There are times when we get together in the name of Christ. Now, if this seems repetitious, don't worry about it. It probably is. You've got to understand this to really be able to breathe free and enjoy your relationship with Christ and not crawl down a road all week long. I want you to stand up, take in the air into your lungs, and enjoy your life with Christ. But you have to understand what I'm saying to you to do that. Otherwise, you put yourself down so much and you are so defeated that you just feel that you can't really enjoy your life with Christ. You cannot enjoy the relationship to a person if you are continually feeling guilty in their presence. Now, that is incidentally an extremely important point for husbands and wives to understand. There are many ways to correct problems in a marriage situation, but the worst way that I know of is to lay a guilt trip on the other person because it takes a chunk out of that relationship, and you're not going to be able to function in a camaraderie with one another if one or the other is feeling guilty all the time. You say, but they do things that they ought to feel guilty about. If you want to press the guilt thing, you may have every right to do it, but don't expect much out of your relationship anymore. See? There are other ways to bring things out. For example, the man that isn't at home as much as he ought to be, I know that story because I'm out a lot. We've been married for, well, it'll be 31 years, I guess, in March, and we've put together something here that survives very well. But here's a man that has to be away from home. He has his job to do. Now, if you're running a business, you are not the judge. I mean, you cannot control that. You either run the business or you don't. If the business calls for you being out, you got to be out. So you have to go with that. There's no middle ground. It isn't even a question of saying, well, we don't need all that money. We need to be together. Well, that's right. You're either going to get no money or you're going to get maybe a lot of money, but you're not. You can't control that. So let's say the husband has to be out. He has to miss dinner tonight, or he is out a little bit. Now, when they finally do get together, often the attitude of the wife has been, I've been in the middle of a lot of counseling situations, so I know what I'm talking about here. So the attitude of the wife is often, well, you should just never spend any time with us. And she spends the time they do have together, she spends all that time telling the guy what a worm he is because he doesn't spend more time with her. But that does not make him feel greatly encouraged to come rushing back to her. He knows that when he does get there, he's going to get a dressing down for it. This is kind of a sidetrack, but on the other hand, it comes back to the basic point, and I will get to it. Let us say now that at long last, the husband and wife have some time together. He's been busy all week. He's been late getting home. Now comes Saturday. He's finally chopped out some time, and they're going to have a little time together. The only way for the woman to handle it is to make that the happiest time he's had all week. Don't badger him about the things he hasn't done, should do, and the marriage is falling apart and all that sort of stuff. Just make it nice. Make it nice. Now, that'll come down to some gutty stuff here in a minute. But you see, if she lays a guilt trip on him, he's not going to want to rush to get back there. It's kind of like people you sometimes visit in the convalescent home or something like that. If you've got a relative that you should visit and you don't visit as much as you should, but when you finally get there, they're crabbing so much about the fact you don't come that you don't want to go back. Anyway, on this, it is never sound to try to build a strong marriage relationship on guilt feelings. By the same token, it is not sound to build a relationship with Christ on guilt feelings. That Christian people do things they shouldn't do is obvious. That they need to ask forgiveness is obvious. But that they should carry a burden of guilt over their inadequacies is not sound. But you get a lot of material over the radio, over the in the pulpits on Sundays. You get a lot of the other thing of trying to put leverage on Christians to perform better. It's always easier to preach a sermon blasting everybody than it is to preach one building them up, lifting them up. And you can get a lot of track record there, people at the altar and so forth, by blasting away, you know. Why didn't you do this? And how come you're like that? Why didn't you do something else? What have you done for Jesus this week? And all this sort of thing. And constantly keeping people on a guilt trip. And there's no joy in a relationship to Christ. Because you'll never do enough. I don't care how much you may try to conform to the patterns, you'll never feel that you've done enough. You'll never have read the Bible enough. You'll never have witness to enough people, you'll never have prayed enough in your own mind to justify enjoying your relationship with Christ. So what I'm trying to say to you is, we're in the struggle. It is as natural for Christian people to rock along and have difficulty as it is for children in the home to have difficulty. Your relationship to your children in the home is an important analogy here. And the way that is handled is something we can look at too in terms of how Christ looks at us, because in some homes the children the young people will never do enough to satisfy the parents, no matter how much they do, the way the relationship goes. Because if they do this but they don't do that, they get, you know, the comeuppance for it. You ask Junior to mow the lawn and also to empty the trash, and you come home and he's mowed the lawn but he hasn't emptied the trash, and what's the first thing you get concerned about? Not gratefully mowed the lawn, but unhappy because he didn't empty the trash. It goes that way constantly. In most homes, one time or another, it's just a rugged, rocky road. But you as parents, right down at the nitty-gritty of it all, if you were confronted with the issue and I were to ask you, do you really hate your children? No, I love them. Do you like them around? Yes, I want them around. Do you want them to come in and talk to you? Yes, I love to have them come in and talk to me. Fine, don't keep them on a guilt trip all the time. Now, by the same token, do you think Christ loves you even though you're rocking along? You as parents should still think the same of your children, even if they're making their mistakes. How much more do you think Christ is at ease with you, even though you're making mistakes? If we ever did achieve in our children what we think God wants from us, they'd be without much life anymore. They'd just be mechanical people doing their chores. There's got to be a sense that Christ loves us, enjoys talking with us, enjoys being with us, even though we go our rounds with him continually. You go your rounds with your children continually. It's always something, isn't it? But you still want them around, and you still want them to come and talk to you, and you still want them to love you, and you still think as highly of them. If you are not a person who has children, but you have been one, you have been a child at some time in your life, and you know the parent-child relationship that I'm talking about. Some of you may have been disappointed in yours, and maybe you had parents that you never felt really cared for you. And if that's true, that's sad, but don't assume that Christ is like that, that because you don't perform well enough, he doesn't care for you. One other point I want to make is a generalization here, that in terms of this matter of the human will or willpower, we find it difficult always to perform as we would like to. If you have a problem with temper, you'd like to be rid of it, but you don't always have that much success. So we have difficulty with our willpower. There is a difference between sinning willingly and sinning willfully. Hebrews says in chapter 10, verse 26, if we sin willingly. Now, the King James translation says, if we sin willfully. It's not quite right. The Greek word means willingly. Now, of course, sin, we're taking in a very broad category. We're going to say, let's assume that we're talking about temper, or let's assume we're talking about some issue that is a problem to you, some habit you have or something. I've talked to a great many people who have personal problems they seem to have difficulty getting hold of, such as the thing, and I'll use this matter of losing one's temper as an illustration, because I get lots of discussion on that. Parents who feel distressed because they can't seem to curb their temper when the kids have been fussing at them and so forth. Let's say that here's a person who loses their temper rather regularly, and they feel therefore defeated, they feel that they are not very good Christian, and so on and so on. My question to them is this. Suppose you have on the table here two buttons, and one button you can press that says no temper. The other button you press says temper. See? Now, which one are you going to press? If you could push a button that would rid you of this habit or this problem, whatever it is, as a Christian, you would push that button. Now, non-Christians probably wouldn't necessarily do that. A non-Christian lives out his life and he doesn't care whether God likes him or not. That's the difference between the Christian and the non-Christian. The thing that guarantees that you're in Christ tonight is that you care about those things. You're not indifferent to it. You want to please the Lord. And if you could push a button that would this night rid you of whatever that problem is, you'd push that button. That shows that you are not sinning willingly. But willfully, maybe, yes. You're in the midst of a problem. The kid had just knocked your favorite vase off the table, destroyed the plant in it, destroyed an irreplaceable vase, and you're going to haul off and sock them. See? And you say to yourself, wait a minute, you know, but you probably will not stop swinging. See, in other words, you're going to follow through all the way. You know you don't want to and you shouldn't and all that, but you're going to follow through. Now, have you sinned willingly or have you sinned willfully? You've sinned willfully. You haven't been able to control your will on that. But not willingly, because you didn't want to. You would rather not do that. Now, I've said to people, it's the attitude that makes the difference, you see. It's your attitude toward Christ. As far as conduct is concerned, I have said to you this, and I want to repeat it because I want you to understand what I'm saying. If you have to sit here three or four nights and listen to the same thing, just thank God that I'm willing to go over it again with you. I don't come out so well as a speaker, but you get the job better. Okay. What I'm saying is not to say you can go ahead and live any way you want because it doesn't matter. That is not what I'm saying. But let's put the weight where it belongs. The things you do in the flesh, you're going to reap the consequences of the flesh in doing them. See? There's a bill to pay if you get careless with your life. There are a lot of things the Lord talks about in the Bible, a lot of things the apostles talk about, Jesus talks about, that are in the best interests of his people. None of the laws that God ever made were made just to make life miserable for you. They were made to give you the best advantage so that you can enjoy life yourself. We've used the illustration of the golfer before. If you ever had any experience with a golf instructor, I don't know whether you ever did or not, you want to wring his neck before you're halfway down the road. Why? Because every time you turn around, there's something new to watch for. You got to get your hands in the right place, your thumb in the right place, your elbow in the right place, your back in the right place, your feet, your nose, your eyes, everything. Watch the ball, watch the trees, watch the hole, everything. Everything's got to... And you feel to yourself, you think to yourself, if I did everything that he's saying, I'd be a pretzel. And you really are. If you ever watch a golfer, it's a pretzel. No, but the point is, if you keep working on this to the point that you've got it automatically part of your swing, you're going to be a lot happier as a golfer. You'll find yourself wrapping the clubs around the tree a lot less times. Whatever distress you feel at the golf pro doesn't hold a candle to the distress you feel if you miss that 5-inch putt. Now, that's an extremely important point. Now, you read the Bible and you see 1,000 things that people ought to do. And that's right, they ought to do those things probably. Not because God wants to make goody-two-shoes out of everybody, but because he wants you to be at peace. And you can't be at peace if you're always in trouble. It's like handling your money. The happiest people in the world are the people that learn to do without enough to keep the budget balanced. Because if your income is $15,000 a year for a low figure. That'll buy you beans every night, maybe. And your expenditures are $15,100 a year. Or if you're spending out $50 or $100 more a month than you're taking in, which is easy to do in this society, in the credit card world, someday there's going to be a piper to pay. And you're not going to be happy. The unhappiness you may feel for having to deny yourself that extra thing you were going to get doesn't hold a candle to the unhappiness you're going to feel when you get to the end of the budget year and you're way in debt. Not any candle to the unhappiness you'll feel when you get that knock on the door or that nasty letter in the mail. So you drive a jalopy and you whistle all the way, or you drive a new Zoom 8 and you sing a mournful tune all the way to the bank. Things that God tells us about in the Bible are things that are designed to help us as human beings function best. But they do not mean the difference between salvation and destruction. You're not going to lose your soul because you make some mistakes, but you may have some bills to pay. Now, one thing that does is help us to learn to accept the responsibility for our actions. There are lots of Christians today who sit around waiting for God to change them, and meanwhile they act ornery all the time. Their whole thinking is, well, I wish someday the Lord would give me a new spirit so I won't act so ornery. And one of the big things is to say, well, just quit acting ornery, you know, or be alone. If you act ornery, you're going to lose your friends. You can be hard to get along with and hard-nosed and selfish and all the rest of it and live miserably. Or you can learn to be more open and less self-centered and be at peace. I've said to you before, the self is the hardest taskmaster of all, because the self is never satisfied. No matter what you give yourself, you're not satisfied with. No matter what goals you reach, you're not satisfied. You want the next thing up. You buy a skateboard, you want a bicycle. You get a bicycle, you want a motorbike. You get a motorbike, you want an automobile. Just that law of diminishing returns, that the more we have, the more it takes to satisfy us. The self is never satisfied. So when you live a life in which you're constantly focused on you, you're going to be miserable. And can you imagine how miserable you'd be if you had to sit and look at yourself in the mirror all day long? You might get tired of yourself after a few hours, depending on the degree of your pulchritude. By the same token, if your life is always centered in you, and a lot of people like that, they can't get on with the business of living because they're always worried about, what are people thinking about me? What's happening to me? How do I come out in this thing? Always looking at problems in terms of, what's it doing to me? Like the wife who says to her husband, I don't want you to die because I don't want you to leave me alone. You know? There are a lot of people like that. They always see the problem in relationship to what they're losing, not in relationship to what the other person is gaining. So that's focus on self. If you focus on yourself, you're not going to go to hell for that, but you're going to be miserable. And you're going to make everybody around you miserable, and you're going to be alone because nobody's going to want to be around you. There's an interesting thing, a certain counseling session I had where the couple were picking at each other. It was a real problem. They were really about to break up. And I said a few simple things to them. We didn't have much time. Next time I got together, it seemed to have changed the picture almost 180 degrees. And one of the simple things I said was, the man was always treating the woman mean or unkindly and snapping at her and everything. And I said, why don't you treat her nice for a change? Be kind to her. I don't know, I suppose it never occurred to him that he might be kind to his wife. He started being kind to her and it changed the whole picture. Now, I'm not saying that the whole burden is on us to satisfy God, because we could never do it. You cannot satisfy the righteous requirement of God apart from Him. On the other hand, you can't make Jesus the scapegoat for all of your orneriness. There's some things you just have to just decide. You're either going to be selfish or you're not going to be selfish. You're going to start thinking of other people. You're going to keep thinking about yourself. Now, if you think about yourself, remember what I'm saying to you. You're not going to go to hell for being selfish, but you're going to make your own hell on earth. Now, there's some things only the Spirit of Christ can do in you. Only the Spirit of Christ can give you peace in your spirit when your life is torn apart and there's no reason for peace. That's something only the Spirit can do. Only the Spirit of God in you can make you care about Christ. Only the Spirit of God in you can make you want to change your life. But don't wait around for some grand religious experience before you start treating your wife or your husband decently. Don't wait for a grand religious experience before you quit thinking about yourself all the time and start maybe thinking about somebody else. And there are things that people do in life that they feel pressed to do, and their plea is, well, I just couldn't seem to help myself, and it's all understandable. But they have to pay the consequences. They go out and get in trouble. Just like in the paying of your bills. If you don't manage your money right, you're going to be in trouble financially. It's not a spiritual matter. Just a dollars and cents, a 1 + 1 = 2 matter. You don't have to, therefore, think you're a poor Christian, but just think that you may be poorly managing your money. Just a lot of things like that that are matters of daily living. That you just be considerate, be thoughtful of people, it helps. I don't want to get too personal on this thing, but on the other hand, to illustrate the point, I mentioned that my wife and I have been married for over 30 years. I'm gone a lot, but I call her every day on the phone. When we are home, we have a nice time together, and I spend time with her. The point I'm making, I say it very soft because I don't want to be too personal about it, except that I want you to know that a lot of men lose their wives because they just ignore them. They're inconsiderate. If you're supposed to be in a certain place at a certain time, you're not going to be there, pick up the old phone and call. It just takes a minute. I use the old KIT formula, keep in touch, keep in touch. If you're going to be late, call. Don't let the poor woman sit there with a dinner getting cold on the table and wondering where in the world you are. Call. It just takes a minute. And that's true with your friends, with everybody. Be considerate, thoughtful. Now, you don't have to have a great religious experience to be thoughtful of people. And you're not going to be read out of the kingdom if you're not thoughtful. But you might lose your home or you might lose your friends. See, there's a lot of practical reality to this thing. As Paul points out here, we are yielded unto God and we are his servants. And he says, verse 16, do you not know that to whom you present yourselves as servants to obey, his servants you are whom you obey, whether of sin unto death or of obedience unto righteousness? But thanks be to God that you were the servants of sin, but you have obeyed from the heart unto the one from whom you have received your teaching. Having been made free from sin, you have become servants with respect to righteousness. Now, that's a very helpful thing. He's saying to these Roman people, whom he has also blistered in several areas, you are the servants of Christ. Now, let us take this matter of being a servant of someone. Let's go back to the old days of the slavery question in Rome. There were slaves in the time of the disciples. If you use the word slave there, what that really means, let us say that you are the slave of a certain master. You are not always obedient to what you're supposed to do. You may make some mistakes, and maybe you get some punishment for it, but you're still his slave. Or let's use an employee-employer relationship. Let's say that you are hired out by a certain company. You're not always as good as they would like you to be about things. Maybe you come in late in the mornings or something, but you're their employee, and you do all right, and they're satisfied with it, and so forth. Now, some friend of yours comes along who needs some help in the field that you are working in. Suppose now you're running a copy machine somewhere. Now, a friend of yours comes along and says, I have a copy machine, and I can't seem to get it to work. Would you give me a hand? Okay, so after hours, you go over and you give him a hand running his copy machine. Now, you're still the employee of the company, but you have given your services to this other person who is not your employer. Now, all right, now let's say that you do your work very well, and you help him out of his jam, and he offers you a job and maybe at better wages, so you go to work for him now. Now you're no longer the employee of employer A, you're employed by employer B. But let's say that employer A comes to you and he says, I know that you're working for employer B over here, but I've gotten into a jam, would you come over and help me? So you go over and help him. That doesn't mean you no longer work for employer B, but you're over doing some work for employer A. Now let's take that into the realm of the two masters, Christ versus Satan. Now let us say that you have been working for Satan, though sometimes you do some charitable deeds or you go to church, but you're still working for Satan as your master. Now you become a Christian, you change masters. You have yielded yourself now to Christ. But, being weak in the flesh, you may slip back and do something for Satan. This is the whole burden of Romans 6. If there were not the likelihood that a person who was a Christian could sin, Paul would have nothing to say in that chapter. The very fact that he has to make a point of, you're yielded to Christ, watch how you live, means that people who are yielded to Christ have to watch how they live. And sometimes they do things that may appear that they're still under orders to Satan, but it's not really that they have changed masters. Now you tonight, here in the place, have yielded yourselves unto Christ. He's your master. You may have left a fairly active life with Satan. If you became a Christian late in life, you probably were rather active in your non-Christian position. And you may sometimes go back to some of those things or attitudes that you had or something like that. But that doesn't mean that you have now left Christ. I gave you the illustration of the matter of the Queen of England last week. If you're a subject of the Queen of England, you're a British subject, you may break some of the laws of the land, but you're still a British subject. You may not be a good one, but you're still a British subject. You're a subject of Christ. You may not function always as you should, but you're still his subject. You've yielded yourself to him. But if you try to go that route of believing that you can make some commitment to Christ that will now cancel out your future sinning, you're going to be laboring under a great disillusion, a great illusion. You're going to be disillusioned about that and defeated about it. There are many ways we can get help from the Lord in the living of our daily lives, many things we can talk to him about, get guidance about from the scripture, but still, as believers, we do have a lot of functioning in the flesh. The only way to ensure a proper attitude toward others is to meet them in the spirit, which means you see them as brothers and sisters in Christ. You come to them that way. You come to them in the name of Christ. I said last week, you're getting together with relatives on the holiday season. If you're getting together with non-Christian relatives, be sure you're going in the name of Christ. If you're going just because there's a blood relationship there, you may be in trouble. You're not going to be a blessing to them. If you go because you believe Christ wants you to be with them, then you can be a blessing to them. You say, well, we're obligated. We can't do anything different. Well, you have to look at your loyalties. Jesus said that you can't be the friend of Christ and the friend of the world, too. You think you have friendships with people that aren't Christians, you may be surprised how far that friendship goes, or with non-Christian relatives. In this disastrous experience of this week with these people down in Suriname or in Guyana, the statement was made that people who were friends would turn and shoot each other and shoot them. You know, they thought they were friends. They were fellowshipping together in that thing. It was not a Christian thing, as it turns out. But I've said to you before, maybe you have non-Christian relatives or neighbors, and they're good people, and you know they try to do the right and so forth, and you've been good friends, you've been neighbors for years, and you're good friends, and I've said to you, if they are not Christians, if they do not belong to Christ, when the chips are down, they'll turn against you. When the chips are down. Don't put too much weight on non-Christian friends. Because when Satan is ready to pull the string on them, he'll pull it, and they'll be used against you. That's true of relatives. Jesus says that. Mothers against daughters-in-law, and daughters-in-law against mothers, and a man's foes shall be they of his own household. So the day is coming when the only distinction will be not blood, but Christ. And there'll be the believers and the non-believers, that's all. Just believers and non-believers, and it cuts right through family lines, right through friendships, through business associations. Only two kinds of people in the world, the believers and the non-believers. And Jesus says, if you want to be a friend of mine, you can't be a friend of the non-believers of the world. That doesn't mean you can't associate with them, but you can't tie up with them, you see.